Welcome to East Meets West, episode 127. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
Thrilled as usual.
Yes.
He is to talk to folks.
It's that enthusiastic, laid-back tone of my voice.
Are we going to go right into spoilers?
For?
Doctor Who.
Doctor Who? You mean the season, this current season, which has already ended?
It has ended in the UK, but it has not ended in the United States.
It's true. It starts next week. And then,
They had the episode with Rose Tyler on Sci-Fi Channel this week.
Yeah.
And then the first of the two episodes that complete the season
starts next week. It's up
on
to you.
Sci-Fi.
What do you think?
I have, however, seen them.
I have already seen them.
Because you know
well.
What? I didn't mind being a couple weeks behind.
Being
the UK
3 to 4 weeks
earlier
behind.
In the season. But when it got to the end and everybody's like talking about it online. You start to figure like, geez, I just want to see the ending.
Well, you don't want to hear about the ending until you see it for yourself because it ruins
exactly,
it.
Exactly. So went ahead and skipped ahead and watched it. Shock!
You've destroyed the temporal space time.
I actually went forward in time and watched them on the Sci-Fi Channel.
It's almost like a reverse TiVo.
Yeah.
And what'd you think?
I liked it. I liked it a lot. I thought the ending was after having such a good episode full of so many perks, so many cool things happening, I thought the ending let me down a little bit.
I thought it was a bit.
And are we going to, should we give a spoiler alert so we can actually
yes,
say why?
Yes, you can give it.
Yeah. Spoiler alert.
For any Doctor Who fans.
For anybody who cares about Doctor Who or haven't seen the final episode yet.
Yeah,
I thought he's just wandering off alone, and Donna never.
I was really excited about the last of the two-parter, and I was so let down, and I'll tell you why.
Why?
One, Billy or Rose Tyler's character really isn't fully used.
You mean Billy Piper's character, Rose
yes,
Tyler?
Rose Tyler.
Yeah, I wanted her in more.
Just felt like she was there to as a plot vehicle to
move
certain
elements.
Yeah, I
thought they could have used her more. I agree with
Sarah
you.
Sarah Jane was kind of superfluous.
That's okay with me, though. I think I didn't mind that because I felt like Sarah Jane needed to be there because that was cool that they brought in like all these past characters. And obviously
all
they're going to bring in her because she's got the series. But I think it would have been bad if they forced her in more.
No, but see, that's the thing. It felt forced already.
I mean, it didn't feel forced to me. But
no,
okay.
Well, for me, it just felt. I feel the whole. Anyways, that's my own gripe with the spinoff. I didn't feel there was enough interaction between Martha Jones and like all the other companions because that's what you would expect.
Yeah,
you would expect instead of them being just isolated, you know, silos of history, but they don't really connect at all. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you see a little bit between Donna and Rose, but Martha is her storyline is keeps her.
But it's a very token kind of grasp, and
I didn't mind that. But I think it would have. I think it's reasonable to assume that they wouldn't all interact.
But it was.
Somehow. But I do agree that if done right, you could have had them all cooperating, and it would have been really cool. So
they didn't even.
I wouldn't call it a negative; just a missed opportunity. Maybe.
I don't think it was. And that's the thing. They didn't necessarily need to cooperate, but they needed to interact. It's like
but see, I like Martha Jones' storyline the way it is. It's reasonable to think that they wouldn't all be, you know, it could be a little cheesy if it's like, oh, look at that. All the past companions happen to be in the room at the same time.
Which they are anyway.
At one point, very briefly, though.
No, and that's for the that was right there until the end of the.
Martha
the
isn't there until the very end.
What are you talking about? She was like trapped in the little silo.
Yeah, exactly. She's not in the same room with the other ones.
With Billy was not
silo. No, she's in the Hagenschnurger device thing. She's away from the rest of them.
Oh, that's right. I'm mistaking Rose and Sarah Jane and Donna.
Ah, yes, they were all together. So that's why Martha Jones. I'm fine with like they keep her away from the rest until the very end. I'm cool with that. Missed opportunity maybe, but that's
I don't know.
That's reasonable because otherwise it gets to be a little too cute.
It's already too cute when you try to bring back all these characters.
No, it's not. Not necessarily.
and then having the hand regenerate into
that
the other
was a little weird.
That
how
wasn't
was
just
hand
a, that,
able to do
that was a little contrived. That was like we need to think of a plot device.
A little too neat to have a second doctor for Rose to take.
You mean a little too convenient, a little too easy?
Yeah,
it was so. That pissed me off more than most because it's like it's so obvious.
Well, you know what was bothering me about it was that, okay, if you're going to go that route and have a second doctor, that bothers me a little bit. But then, oh, and he's half human.
And he will age.
Well, he's half Donna Noble. So Rose and Donna Noble are in love? The half Donna Noble? I don't buy it.
I don't buy the fact that this doctor is like a total pushover, like the second one.
Yeah.
Because we all know that the doctor himself is pretty outspoken, and so is Donna. You combine both of them, and you get a really quiet person who's like just mills around while the doctor and Rose have their final say.
What do you mean he just mills around?
Like right at the end, he's at the back, and they're on the beach. You don't think he would try to interject other than try to reinforce what the doctor was saying? It's just
maybe not. I could buy that.
I don't know.
I don't think he would necessarily. Because he knows that the main doctor, is going to say all the same things that he would say.
Maybe, but he's only the half.
What is he going to do? Argue?
But that's my point.
He gets Rose. If he, I'd shut up if I were him too.
I don't know. It's not like she was exactly pleased. Anyway,
I'm not buying all of your arguments. But
no,
I was.
You just said that he was half Donna and half.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't think there's that outspoken part of Donna that would just say, "Hey, you know."
But not only if he disagreed.
I don't think he would have. I think you know the second doctor would have said something to the effect that, you know, look, this is what's going to happen. You know, I think there needs to be a big at least a noticeable personality shift. And I think I don't know.
You know what? They tried to make it be like him saying things that Donna would say. And I didn't think it worked.
But only in the beginning. That
yeah.
Was
but I didn't think it worked. Did you?
I don't.
Did you feel like, oh wow, that really is like a little bit of Donna? I was like, really? That's what Donna would say? Well, I guess. It didn't sound like her.
I don't know. That whole thing left
me.
I
think she did a better job, and maybe it's a problem with David Tennant, but I think
she did a better job
sounding like she had a little bit of the Doctor in her.
Yeah, no.
Than he did of sounding like he had a little bit of Donna Noble. Like him saying wizard, it was like, don't buy it.
No. I do agree with you on that point, but I think the extra doctor was a little too convenient.
I will totally agree with you on is by the end, the second doctor was just kind of a pale imitation of the doctor. There was no attempt to have him be Donna Noble-ish.
I don't know. It's that I don't know, and the fact that the Daleks were still around and that one mentally deranged one actually knew everything and was trying to help the doctor. You know, did you find that at the end?
No, I think that goes into the good traditional cheesiness of Doctor Who, because that's what would be insanity to a Dalek is to help the Doctor.
I just think, in the end, I think it was an all right episode. I think it could have been a lot better.
I got there in different ways, I suppose, but I kind of tend to agree in the end, which was, I would say it was more than an all right episode, especially the first half.
The first episode was good. Was a good lead-in. I thought it was great.
It was a great episode.
The second of the two-parter.
Ending of
let
the
me down.
Part.
It just let me down.
Let me down.
I was expecting so much more.
And it also doesn't point in any direction where we're going with the four specials. Because if you don't know, there's going to be four specials out in 2009, directed by what's his name, the current executive producer.
Oh, he's going to be at Comic-Con.
How have I totally forgotten his name suddenly? Before he hands it over to Stephen Moffat, who will be the new producer for the next full season, which won't be till 2010.
Or is that Stephen Moffat that's going to be at Comic-Con?
I don't know.
Stephen
Moffat might be at
Comic-Con. I'm flying in the day they have the Doctor Who panels. They're having Doctor Who, Torchwood,
so
Doctor
miss
Who.
Those?
Yeah, they're all in the morning. My plane doesn't get in until 12:45, and
why
then I have
you,
to.
Why are you flying in late?
I have to work Wednesday.
Tom. Why don't you just take that day off too?
Because I believe in making sure that everything is all wrapped.
Well, then don't complain about missing them. It's your own.
Uh huh. Hey, up yours, buddy.
I don't know about your Eastern ways of believing in shifting blame.
I'm not shifting blame. Who am I shifting blame on? I'm just saying. I'm just. I'm gonna
Comic Con for having the.
I didn't blame anyone. I just said I'm gonna be missing.
You're so easy to get going.
Oh, you're so Anglo about it.
There we go. That's what I was. Russell Davies, Russell T. Davies. How could I forget?
Divide
Russell?
And conquer.
Russell T. Davies
works so well in India, in the Far East. Oh, in Africa. The Middle East.
Oh, I think Confucianism has taught us a little bit about dominating as well.
Uh-huh. Whatever.
That's the best you got? Whatever.
Well, what do you want me to say?
I don't want you to say anything.
Uh-huh. You want me to say a lot. That's what you want me to do.
I thought we should inject a little more East meets West into this.
This is the whole Doctor Who thing is less East meets West and more just kind of British sensibilities, which you may or may not agree with. For the most part, I like Doctor Who. There's just certain things I just find not infuriating, but really annoying.
Throw out an example.
Well, for one, I mean, I understand the Doctor's adventures take place, you know, around the universe and through time, but how could they always run into people that all speak English and have roughly the same kind of...
Yeah, but that's a complaint about Star Trek
I hate that. Stargate, it works because they're all supposed to be offshoots of humanity.
Yeah.
Star Trek has no excuse, and it's why I hate that, too.
Well, the excuse for all of them, including Stargate, is it's a hell of a lot cheaper on your special effects budget.
But I'm not...
And the audience identifies more with the storyline that way
than
they do if you have, you know, the Star Trek Next Generation episodes where they tried to abandon that and they met the intelligent crystal and all of that. They worked. They were good episodes. But you can't make a whole season out of that and expect it to be popular.
I don't know. I just think it's just really odd that it's just... Can't they have or at least have a name for the people or something? It just...
Have a name for the people. There is plenty of good names for people in Doctor Who. That's not
not proper names, but I mean, like, you know, every time they pop in, it's just like, hey, you're just one of us, and no one really questions. You're just another. You know what I mean? No one spots them as an outsider.
Spots Doctor Who as an outsider.
Yeah, automatically, it's like, hey, they're outsiders. They're except in the new episode, except in the new season when they go underneath the tunnel. It's like, you know, which part of who are you with? But
and that's full of humans.
I just think it's just. I don't know. And half fishmen. Don't forget the fishmen,
right.
Tom.
Fishmen on the other side.
But it's okay if they're non-human, right? You can forget about them. Well, oh, whatever.
They aren't in the episode that much. Most of the time is spent with the human ones.
Oh, I see. Because they're in for like 60. They're only in for 40% of the time. It's easy to dismiss them.
Well, you're
dismissing them
in your whole theory of saying that they never have people who don't recognize them outsiders, except for this episode. The episode with the fishmen doesn't count.
You're
throwing out the fish.
No,
yourself.
I just saying that's a what do they call it?
It's called logical.
I think it's called the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, whatever. Let's go visit the flying Titanic. Woo! Bunch of vacationers. Aren't they just a mirror image of like modern contemporary society? That's the other thing that
The other thing about season one, because I just rewatched season one, that second episode where he takes her to the end of the earth.
The end of the earth or the end of the universe?
Well, the end of the earth.
Where with
in the second episode, he takes her to the end of the earth, and there's the last human who's all stretched out, just a big
skin.
It's when the earth is about to blow up.
Yep.
And they did a better job of having the attendant aliens not all be human, including the last human.
But see, and again, it's something you've only seen of late with this new crop.
Ah, I see. You're
but okay. I mean, I'm looking right now. I'm looking at Davros and the first Dalek here and
Genesis of the Daleks, the Tom Baker era.
But you know, and it's interesting. It's like they didn't always start out that way. I think they did it like you were saying. They wanted something that people could latch onto.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, every time they do, it just lacks that kind of otherworldness, that alienness that you would expect.
New series definitely have a lot more of that otherworldness in more episodes. The old Doctor Who was budget constrained.
That's true, but I mean, it didn't stop them from making an oversized pepper shaker
The Dalek looks like it is, because they're like, oh, well, we got it. Got a whisk and a plunger. Okay, put it on some cardboard and, you know, put some nodules on it. That's about all the props department can
afford. Wood. It's wood.
Yeah.
But
I put a tricycle inside it so somebody can ride it around.
But even like, I don't know, even Star Trek, I mean, I understand the budget constraints, but even Star Trek is kind of, I mean, I think Babylon 5 did a much better job.
You're always bringing up Babylon 5.
When was the last time I brought it up?
Oh, I don't know, 2 or 3 episodes ago.
4 or 5? What are you talking about?
I would like someone who listens regularly to give a count.
Fine. But I'm saying Babylon 5 had a much smaller budget than Star Trek The Next Generation, did a much better job not only creating the aliens, but giving...
The aliens are all humanoid. Aren't they?
No. You obviously have never watched...
I haven't watched that much.
Right. Yeah.
I'll admit.
The Vorlons are giant things of energy. The shadows are giant spider creatures.
Oh, the, spiders, because, you know...
Oh, geez.
Earth animals are everywhere in the universe.
Spider-like creatures. How do you like that?
Derivative.
Yeah. Hey, never mind.
The Dalek doesn't look like a human animal. Or an earth animal.
Yeah, it looks like an earth pepper shaker.
Only because that's what your frame of reference can understand.
I'm sure that's what the prop maker's frame of reference was, too.
I don't think so. I don't think
we made a dustbin with wheels and, you know, little nodules.
Shall we take some comments?
Yes. Actually, that's what it looks like. It looks like an oversized trash bin.
V says, I was watching...
Wait a minute. Who?
V says, I was watching the Twit live stream when Waz was on. He said he had gone to the same store last year and stood in line. Also, he said people in line wanted him to go first last year. And think about it. The people in that line are a bunch of Apple fanboys who got to meet Waz. There probably weren't that many objections. Yeah, that thing kind of blew over already, I guess. But there you go. Some more.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
That's what we talked about last episode.
I mean, I know that.
Rodrigo says, I think it's amazing. Every time you guys comment on the number of comments, you get a lot of it.
How many comments have we had this time?
Let's see. This time we got 13.
13.
Lucky 13.
Maybe we can beat that next time.
Says, I have just one thing to say about the iPhone. Why does that have to be so expensive in Canada? Stupid Rogers and Fido put the price
high
that I can't get it. So I guess I am not buying a new phone this
year. Stupid Roger.
I haven't bought Rogers.
I know. I just like, I like feeling indignant.
I haven't bought the new iPhone. I'm still using the old one, firmware too. Because I'm curious to get the new iPhone, but I'm not willing to go stand in a line for more than an hour.
Any Canadian listeners, please tell me. From what I understand, the Canadian dollar is about par, maybe a little under, with the American dollar. Why is everything still priced like in the Canadian pricing structure? Which means, like, you know, even if like the Canadian dollar and the American dollar are on par, $1 Canadian equals $1 American, you still pay more in Canada.
Well, that's just the economy there. I mean, it doesn't matter that the dollar for dollar is equal. They're just saying it costs more. There's more taxes. Maybe.
But it's like they didn't even. It's like it was a. There's an automatic just, you know, percentage.
It's the price over. You're assuming you're making the assumption that I know you're not really making, which is that price difference. The only difference between prices in different regions is currency exchange, and that's not true.
No,
I mean, things are cheaper in Kansas than they are in California, and it's still all dollars.
That's true, but for certain things like. Books or even like electronics. Yeah, you do have a percentage dedicated overhead, but does it actually equate to the same?
Or tax.
For example, like say...
Or demand.
Say like 6 or 7 years ago when the Canadian dollar was what, like 75 American cents.
Uh-huh.
And that same price, for example, say your notebook here costs $1,200, but over there it would cost 17. Even with the increase in price, it's still 17.
Yeah. Well, that makes perfect sense to me, actually. If you have a market that is willing to pay $1,700 for something,
but they don't,
you don't go look at the currency exchange and say, oh, well,
yeah, but
U.S.
but
dollar change, let's lower the price.
But
no,
but
you continue to price based on what people will pay, and if they'll pay $1,700,
yeah, but that's the point. They're not. That. They're actually buying it over here, and they're importing it back up.
Well, obviously not, or they would lower the price.
Well, that's a major complaint. So I would like to hear it from a Canadian perspective and not necessarily Tom's.
All right.
From any listeners who could fill me in.
Speaking of not Canadian or American, Rossi Brown writes, I am most disappointed that Roger didn't rise to the challenge of discussing the intellectual finer points of security theater. Don't worry, Roger. I'll let you get away with it this time.
Well,
the reason I bring it up is I was recently in London where I met with Udayan Tripathi. Yes, we know Udayan. He's if you enjoy the graphics that come with the East Meets West podcast, they're all made by Udayan, everybody. We spent the better part of the afternoon at Starbucks discussing a variety of topics, including security theater. While we were both quick to dismiss security theater as the way forward in the war against terror, or however the White House are marketing it these days, neither of us could come up with an appropriate security response. How do you protect your homeland from a constantly evolving and not often clearly defined threat?
You know what's interesting, though? It's easy to dismiss the concept of, quote, security theater as kind of empty gesturing, but if you can placate or at least calm, animation placates probably won't work, but calm a population so they don't go hysterical, I think that's a good thing. I mean, a lot of the things they did during World War II, for example...
Well, it's the classic science fiction episodes use that principle all the time when they say, we can't allow the public to know about this or they'll panic.
Well, it's one of those... It's a balance.
To avoid public panic.
Well, you're trying to avoid where people just say... Will people say that, you know, for example, the airline industry was hit right after 9/11. It was one of the steps that, you know, the TSA did here was, you know, to at least put in the prospective passenger's mind that flying is once again safe. You know, not necessarily, you know, a hollow out, a very important and very, you know, a lucrative industry, you know, not only in terms of, you know, money spent, but also, you know, taxes and all that. That said, I don't think it's a substitute for, you know, more stringent measures, which is interesting since I believe Rossi Brown is from Britain.
Yes.
That Labour did pass a 40
from Scotland, if I'm correct.
42-day detention bill. Is it a bill in Britain? What do they call it? Law or whatever. So they can keep a terrorist suspect, you know, in jail for at least 42 days without having to necessarily formally charge him or her anything. So it's that could be considered security theater. That could be considered, you know, a ham-fisted approach.
I suppose the alternative to security theater is security.
Well, you know, and that brings up the question, you know, how do you define security? Do you define security where you have absolute control, you know, over? So if everyone, you just don't go out after 6, we'll have a curfew at 6 o'clock.
Right.
We can better, you know, manage.
Well, but there's a different, you know, yes, you can get into the different ways you implement security from a very high level controlling way that gets rid of all civil liberties in the face of security versus a more compromised way, which preserves civil liberties and still attempts to create security. But I think that's still, either way, is different than security theater, which is more of a crowd control measure, right?
Yeah.
It's not actually about security.
But it's also a relative term. I mean, some people would consider, you know, doing background checks on people who of a specific origin and taking, for example, certain classes in university. You know, for example, taking chemistry, you know, and a bunch of other stuff, they would consider that security theater, while, for example, the intelligence agency would say that it's actually a very legitimate tool for them to spot potential suspects.
Right. Well, that's why I say they're two different things. If you're doing it just because you think it makes you look good to the public, or might make you look better, like you're going to secure things to the terrorists, that's security theater. If you're doing it because you say, look, I've got a much higher percentage chance of catching somebody if I do this.
But my point is it depends on the perspective of the person looking at it. For some, they could say, well, I think security theater.
All you're saying is a single action could be either
interpreted
security theater or regular security or both.
Yep.
It's not even about perspective. It's the fact that one action could serve both, in which case, to me, it's like, well, then forget about the effects of theater. I would only focus on the effects of actual security, because I think the real debate isn't about security theater. The real debate is what level of balance should we have between civil liberties and security? I mean, what is that balance? What should it be? And I am in favor of a high level tilted towards civil liberties, because what you're trying to protect with that security is civil liberties, is freedom. And I am a big believer that if the terrorists are trying to take away our freedom, you can't beat them by taking away our freedom.
See, you know, I never really bought that to begin with.
Well, yeah.
I've always felt that their prime goal was either massive economic damage,
they want to bring down the government.
Yeah.
That's essentially what they want.
Government / society.
Yeah.
So probably shouldn't.
And bringing down the society brings down the government.
Yeah.
Moral Anarchy says, I can't believe Tom said the lesser of two evils is exaggerated. He quotes George Washington and Thomas Paine. Government in its best state is a necessarily evil, said Thomas Paine. Government is not reason, it is not eloquence, it is force. Like fire, it is a dangerous servant. Key words, government is evil. No, it's not. Government is not evil. I know Thomas Paine said it was a necessary evil, but I don't think he's saying it's evil.
I
was saying it was not evil. What I was saying is government isn't evil. Government isn't out to get you. Government isn't against you. Government isn't trying to kill you. It is a necessary evil the way a lock on your door is a necessary evil. Do you consider a lock on your door immoral and evil? No. Would you rather live without it? Yeah. Do you keep one? Yes. Is it evil? No. That's the kind of process I'm going over here with government. So, I mean, what I don't like is when people discuss these things and use extremes and then adhere to only extreme definitions of everything.
Well,
you know,
it's not even
when
that.
You say government is a necessary evil. I don't think Thomas Paine was, but I don't think you have to believe that like government is out to get you and kill everyone and we must fight it back.
But I mean, at the same time, I think terms like evil and good are inherently loaded terms.
Let's finish out his comment, too. He says, government is a moral evil because its existence requires the initiation of force upon the innocent. You can debate about whether it's a necessary evil or not, and you can debate whether a lack of government will result in more or less evil, but I don't think you can argue that government is not inherently evil. Well, I can. I do. I respect your opinion. It's very much an anarchist opinion. And there's a lot, and I don't mean that as a pejorative. I mean, there's a lot of good, solid thinking behind anarchist thought, and it's propounded on this. But I do not think that government is inherently evil, because government is inherently humans, and I don't think humans are inherently evil. But that doesn't mean government can't be evil. Now, this is the interesting part there, where he says, government's existence requires the initiation of force upon the innocent.
No.
Because if he's right, then he's got to.
Wait.
Then the rest of everything he says
like
follows.
First of all, like I said, evil and good, those are terms are loaded and they're relative terms.
Exactly.
For example, say, you know, granted, some people may think the U.S. is the great Satan, but for the majority of the citizens, they voluntarily submit themselves to those laws because they see it as not benefiting only themselves.
Not every single person does, but the majority do.
I mean, for example, the reason why you stop at a stop sign is not only because you're conditioned to, but because, hey, if I stop, I don't plow into someone else
right.
who doesn't have one. That way I save myself injury as well as the other person. It's only evil if you directly impose yourself, where people talk about authoritarian regimes or fascist regimes, where, you know, either the good of the individual or the good of the society, quote unquote, requires that certain measures be taken.
Again, not saying that governments can't be evil. They can.
Yeah. But like you said, government is made up of people, and it's really dependent on those people, you know, who are in power, but also the people who elect them to guide the course. And that's why, you know, both Tom and I are very, you know, active proponents of people voting and being in part of the political process, because if you kind of sit down and kind of lean back and not do anything at all, yeah, you let those particular currents take over instead of you being, you know, an active a force within it.
I mean, to bring it down to a level that maybe may help you get to where we are, not to say you'll necessarily agree with us, but think of the examples we're giving in relation to small governments. Building governments, like in condo councils, small town school boards,
the bowling league,
even clubs. The International Socialist Club probably has officers, and that has a government. Those are governments.
And the thing is, government is an organization. It's not some kind of intangible construct that is always present and always there looking out to put the giant thumb of oppression on your forehead.
And again, I'm not saying that it isn't valid to argue that most governments tend to be evil. I think you could make a good case for that, actually. But the idea that government itself is somehow evil.
Well, it's an act. It's like saying, like, you know, forming a group, like three people, is like forming any kind of society is evil.
Yeah.
It's not inherently good or evil. It is just a representation of how human individuals form together to form, you know, a greater mechanism in order to work out certain things. For example, like, you know, if you're in a you're part of a club, you need someone who can manage the day-to-day operations, you know, whether it's finance or whether or not, you know, you guys are going to rent a tour bus to go to Yosemite this year.
And those things could go badly. You can have evil club governments. I mean, I think we've all seen them.
And you could end up in some, you know, an Oxnard instead of like, you know.
There's politics and people get their feelings hurt.
But and that all goes back to people. Yeah. I mean, individuals. I mean, that's what makes the government what it is. It's not, at some level, yeah, it can run autonomously, but that's only if you let it.
I guess what I'm saying is government is a screwdriver. You can kill somebody with a screwdriver, or you can fix an electrical outlet with a screwdriver.
It's strictly a tool.
Yeah, and I'm willing to entertain the argument that it's not a screwdriver.
It's more like a gun, Tom.
Yeah.
It's a loaded weapon.
Well, you know, guns don't kill people. Governments kill people. Wait a minute. Maybe they are evil. All right. Well, that brings us to the end. Thanks for listening, folks. A little Doctor Who, little government is evil.
Yeah. I may or may not be here depending on what time my flight gets in on Sunday.
Okay. So we might do it later.
Yeah, because of Comic-Con. So anyone who's going to Comic-Con, please let me know. I'll try to meet up with you.
I think SoCal Jess had a posting about Comic-Con. If I'm correct. Yes, she says, my Comic-Con vacation starts Wednesday through Saturday. I may be in my manga shoujo costume, or maybe not. With all the fanboys and gamers about, it's going to be Where's Waldo, or rather, Where's Raji? and then she actually has a comment back to Moral Anarchy about government being evil.
And then, you should Twitter. It's like, I saw Roger.
They should get on one of those bright kite or whatever those things are. Yeah, where they can tell people where you are.
Except does it work with the... Pearl? I'll have to check that out.
I think if you check in and say where you are, it does. I'm not sure about the GPS portion.
Mm. All right.
See you later, folks.